Eh bien, nous avons à la fois le très grand plaisir et le très grand honneur d'avoir aujourd'hui avec nous Robert Zatorre. Je pense qu'il ne nécessite pas une très grande introduction, compte tenu du fait que ses travaux, d'une qualité exceptionnelle, sont largement connus dans le monde de l'audition et bien au-delà. Alors, Robert Zatorre a suivi un double cursus en psychologie et en musique, puis a fait et ceci à Boston, puis a fait ensuite de ça un PhD en psychologie expérimentale. Aujourd'hui, il co-dirige l'institut dont vous avez tous entendu parler, plutôt le laboratoire Brahms de Montréal, avec Isabelle Pérez, dont les travaux, je pense que vous connaissez aussi Isabelle Pérez, mais sont assez distincts de ceux de Robert Zatorre. Alors, Robert Zatorre s'intéresse à la perception de la musique et à la cognition musicale, et ses travaux éclairent tout particulièrement l'émotion que suscite la musique. Aujourd'hui, il va nous parler de la musique et de la perception musicale et de son substrat neuronal dans le cadre de la perception et du plaisir. Alors, pour introduire sa conférence, qui n'a sans doute pas besoin de cette citation, mais c'est une citation que j'aime beaucoup, de Lévi-Strauss, « La musique et la mythologie sont des machines à supprimer le temps. » Si bien qu'en écoutant la musique et pendant que nous l'écoutons, nous accédons à une sorte d'immortalité. Que la musique soit un langage à la fois intelligible et intraduisible, fait de la musique elle-même le suprême mystère des sciences de l'homme, celui contre lequel elle bute et qui garde la clé de leur progrès. Alors là, c'est le versant perceptif, le versant neurophysiologique de la neurocognition que nous allons aborder. Je vous donne la parole.
Merci beaucoup, Madame Petit. Je suis très très content d'être ici parmi vous.
Est-ce que j'ai tout de même, comme habituellement, oublié de mentionner les points critiques, c'est-à-dire le fait que vous avez reçu de nombreux prix.
Oh, ça c'est pas.
À tout de même. Le prix Ibsen, le prix de la Fondation Ibsen sur la plasticité neuronale, dont vous allez sans doute nous parler. Le prix Knowles, qui est un prix de la spécialité en audition, mais qui n'est décerné que tous les 3-5 ans, enfin, quand quelqu'un d'exceptionnel est considéré comme devant l'obtenir. Et puis vous êtes membre de la Royal Society du Canada. Et j'en oublie sûrement un certain nombre d'autres.
Merci beaucoup. Alors, oui, c'est très bien. Je suis très content d'être ici. C'est toujours un grand honneur d'être invité par des organismes français de grande reconnue. Et puis, c'est aussi particulièrement agréable d'être à Paris au mois d'avril, parce que chez nous, il y a toujours de la neige. Et ici, vous avez des fleurs. Je passe à l'anglais pour la conférence, mais n'hésitez pas à me poser des questions en français si vous aimez plutôt la langue de Molière. So, what I will try to tell you about in the next hour or so is some of the work we've done over the past 30 years or so, really trying to understand, on the one hand, how it is that music is processed in terms of its cognitive basis in the brain, but also why it is that it gives us strong emotional responses. And one question that often came up, especially early in my career when we were just starting to do research on music, and this was particularly on the part of granting agencies and reviewers, they would ask, well, why is it that you want to study music? Sometimes they would be a little more hostile and they would say, why don't you study something important like memory or language? And there are many answers to this question, but I like to give this one, which is actually carved in stone outside of our institute in Montreal. If you ever come to visit us, you will see this quotation from our founder, Wilder Penfield. And what he said is that the problem of neurology is to understand man himself. In slightly more contemporary language, you might say neuroscience is trying to understand what it is to be human. So it was a very broad view that he had. It wasn't just about, let's say, curing a specific disorder, for instance, although that's obviously extremely important too. But what he was saying, I think, is that if we really want to understand the human brain, we need to look at all aspects of what it is to be human. And I would argue that art in general, and music in particular, is such a central part of the human existence that we really have to try to figure that out if we want to fulfill Penfield's idea. So I'm sure many of you are quite familiar with the cortical auditory system, but just to give you a very quick overview, the auditory cortex is found roughly on the superior temporal gyrus, as illustrated here. And like other sensory systems, it consists of core, belt, and parabelt areas organized in a concentric manner. And I won't talk so much about the properties of the auditory cortex itself, because that would take not just one lecture, but the entire month, I think. But I will just give you one illustration from some research that we've done recently, which I think is a good example of some of the properties of the auditory cortex that are most relevant for music, and that has to do with encoding of pitch information, specifically the so-called frequency following response. And this is from some work done by one of my former postdocs, Emily Coffey. And what we did here was, using magnetoencephalography, we measured the response to a periodic sound. And as is well known, has been described by many, many other researchers, you get this frequency following response in the low frequencies, which arises from many different parts of the brain, notably from subcortical structures, so especially inferior colliculus, but also from the medial geniculate and as far down as the cochlear nucleus. But what we were able to demonstrate using magnetoencephalography is that there's also a very strong cortical response, which is actually lateralized, stronger on the right. And this is just the amplitude of the response. What's interesting is that this amplitude, as plotted here, correlates with individual differences in a psychophysical task of pitch discrimination. So people who have a relatively poor threshold have relatively low activity here, whereas people who have a very good threshold, a very high ability to distinguish different frequencies, have the larger values here. So it's a nice link between cortical representation and behavioral ability. And this is a finding which we've subsequently replicated using an fMRI paradigm with two different types of stimuli, and you see you get a response here in the cortex. So this is one of the many properties of the auditory cortex. It's extremely relevant for music because it would be very hard to conceive of a musical system that did not have some kind of manipulation of frequency information. Now, I'm going to spend more time talking about the pathways that emerge from the auditory cortex and go to other cortical targets. And these are roughly, can be divided roughly into two pathways, one a more dorsal one and one a more ventral one. And these have been described in the monkey, for example, by Joseph Rostricker and others. And there's good evidence in the human brain that there are these two pathways as well. They're sort of parallel to the very well-known visual dorsal and ventral streams. Now, the dorsal pathway has targets in the parietal cortex, as well as in the premotor cortex and in dorsolateral prefrontal regions. And it's associated with a number of different abilities. The ones that I'm going to focus on here are the ability to manipulate information in working memory and also sensory motor integration. And I'll give you some examples of findings that support the importance of this dorsal stream for those functions. So what do we mean by manipulating information in auditory working memory? Well, there are several ways to do this. A lot of people have done this with speech stimuli, We've done it with musical stimuli. One nice thing about music is that it allows you to do some pretty complex types of tasks. So here, this is a study done by Nick Foster, one of my former PhD students. What you will hear is a little melody, and then that melody will be followed by a transposed version of it. So it's the same pattern of sounds, but at a different pitch height. So it's in a different key, speaking musically. And your job is to indicate if the stimulus is the same or different. So if you hear this as the target, and then you hear this as the comparison, is it the same melody? Yes? Okay. If you listen to this one, you see what the difference might be. That's not the same melody, right? Okay. If you didn't get that, you need to talk to my colleague Isabel Peretz, who studies amusia. So the idea here is that all of the individual elements are different, right? What is the reason you can tell if it's the same melody or not is because you've encoded the relationships between those different pitches. So it's the musical intervals that are retained as constant, not the individual values. That's one type of manipulation. Another type of manipulation is in time. So the first one is a manipulation in frequency space, and the next one is a manipulation in time. So if you hear this melody, oops, and then you hear this one, it's exactly reversed, right? Now here I'm of course showing you the musical notation that makes it a lot easier. This is a pretty difficult task, but people can do this. You don't have to be musically trained to do it, although if you have musical training, you are better at it. So when we do these kinds of tasks, we find very consistently brain activity using fMRI in this dorsal pathway, particularly in the intraparietal sulcus, and in this experiment also in the SMA. This is for the reversal. Here's for the transposed melodies, a very similar pattern. These are from two different experiments. And then we did a third experiment testing the same individuals with the two types of tasks so that we could look at the conjunction of them. And once again, it's an extremely consistent pattern. We always get the intraparietal region along with the SMA, supplementary motor area, and very often these premotor regions here, which are a little less prominent, but more prominent over here. So it's really the entire dorsal pathway that is involved in performing these kinds of operations, which are, these two things are very different from one another, but they both involve not only retaining the information, but also working on it. So you're not simply comparing one thing to another thing, you're comparing it after having done some kind of transform of it. We have some very nice recent evidence that is more causal in nature from some work done by Philippe Albouy, who is a postdoc in my lab right now, and he's from Lyon. And in this experiment, we do the same sort of task, simplified with just three notes. So you hear three tones, and then you hear another three tones, and they're either in the same order or they're reversed. And with magnetoencephalography, again, we're measuring the oscillation that is occurring, the power in different frequency bands that is occurring during the time period in between. So there's a 2-second gap when there's no stimulus. So this is not stimulus-driven, right? It's not an evoked response. It's the activity during the mental, during the time in which the mental transformation is happening. And we get a nice peak here in the 5 hertz band. And the idea here was that we were identifying this oscillatory signature in order to then stimulate that region, which is indeed the parietal cortex. You can see it here. And this is our target region. So now we're going to stimulate it with transcranial magnetic stimulation. The advantage of this is that it allows us to have a direct perturbation of the activity of that system. But what Philippe wanted to do was not just to disrupt the system. He actually wanted to enhance it. So he used a rhythmic TMS protocol where the pulses are aligned at the same 5 hertz rhythm as the oscillatory signature that we saw here. And when we do that, we see an improvement in behavior. So this is from baseline to the rhythmic TMS, an improvement in D prime, which does not happen with a control condition where you still have five pulses over 1 second, but they're not arranged in a periodic fashion. They're just arrhythmic. And this improvement is really specific to this manipulation task, not to a simple comparison. So supporting the idea that this dorsal stream is involved in specifically in the manipulation of information, not just its retention. And nicely, the degree to which there is an improvement across individuals is correlated with the degree to which this theta power is enhanced by the TMS. So you get these pulses, they enhance your oscillatory activity to a lesser or to a greater extent for different individuals, and the degree to which that happens is also linked to the degree to which your ability to manipulate these stimuli improves. So these experiments, I think, are pretty clear in demonstrating the role of this dorsal stream in the ability to work on information that you are retaining in working memory. I also mentioned that the dorsal stream is involved in sensory motor types of tasks. We have several different kinds of studies on that. There's one recent one that I want to show you, which is carried out by Indiana Woolman, who is, again, one of my former postdoctoral trainees. She is now here in Paris at the Philharmonie de Paris. There, she's back in the audience. And so Indiana was working with Melanie Segado and Virginia Penhune on a project where we have this device, which is the world's only MRI-compatible cello, which actually fits in the scanner. You see it there. And the participant is holding the bow. It's a tiny little bow like this. And so we can slide the person into the MRI scanner, and we can actually scan them while they are performing the task. And what we did was train people to play this device over a period of several weeks. And there are various interesting findings from here, but the one that I want to highlight is the following. So these are the brain areas which are active when people are listening to the stimulus that they have to play, just listening. And what happens is that after the training, so after 4 weeks, but not before, you get recruitment of these dorsal regions just when listening, which means that the learning process itself has enabled a kind of coupling between the sensory system and the motor system, such that when you now hear the stimuli that you've learned have a motoric representation, you activate this dorsal stream. And this finding is actually nicely duplicated in another study that we did using a piano intervention that was carried out by Sibylle Herholtz. And we get very similar responses in the dorsal stream, more of a left side response with the piano because it was mostly a right hand task, and more of a right side response in the cello because most of the action in the cello is over here on the left hand, less so with the right hand. But the point is that the dorsal stream, these parietal and premotor regions, are involved in this sensory motor integration. So much for the dorsal stream. Now let's turn to the ventral stream for a moment. And the ventral stream is involved in a number of different kinds of functions. And many of these descriptions actually are coherent with what's been described in vision, by the way. So the idea of sensory motor interactions from the dorsal stream, for instance, is quite compatible with what Mel Goodale talks about in the visual motor domain, like reaching and grasping for objects and adjusting the position of one's hand to grasp an object. Similarly, for the ventral stream, a lot of people talk about the processing of visual objects in this more ventral stream. And what we've been looking at are a number of different types of cognitive functions which are linked to the ventral stream. One of them has to do with the representation of abstract stimulus features. So what I mean by that is that the core and belt areas are involved in the representation of pitch information, as I showed you earlier. But then you have to not only represent that information, but also these relationships. And so to look at that, one of my former students, Mike Klein, did an experiment where we asked musicians to listen to these patterns, which are musical intervals. So these are all minor thirds, these are all major thirds, these are all fourths. And if you are trained in music, you can determine that this is a minor third. This is also a minor third. And so is this. That's because they all have the same ratio of frequencies. Whereas this is a major third, and this is a perfect fourth. So what happens in the experiment is that you get all nine of these stimuli randomly presented, and then we use a decoding algorithm. So this is using a multivariate pattern classifier, where we're looking not at the magnitude of the response in the fMRI, but rather the degree to which the pattern of activity in those voxels can be used by a classifier to determine what stimulus was presented. And the interesting finding is that in these regions of ventral auditory cortex, we find decoding of all of the minor versus all of the others, and also all of the major intervals versus the other two, and so forth. So it's a category representation. It doesn't distinguish this one from this one from this one. It distinguishes all of these from all of those. That's because in a musician's brain, these stimuli correspond to learned categories. And the place where this information is most highly represented is in this ventral auditory region in the superior temporal sulcus, which we see bilaterally in this experiment. So this is one example of what the ventral stream is important for. It's for representing these more abstract levels. And I think this corresponds to something like in vision, where you might have more primitive features in early visual cortex, like edges or angles. And then you put those things together to form kind of primitive objects, like rectangles and circles and things like that. I mentioned also that the ventral stream is involved in working memory retention. And I was trying to think when I was preparing this talk, so what's a good experiment to show the role of the ventral stream in working memory? And I went back to this very old study, which was done by Séverine Samson and I back when we were extremely young. I think we were only like 10 years old or so, Séverine. Isn't that right? And this is a lesion experiment where we looked at patients who had excisions of the auditory areas in the temporal lobe and also frontal cortical damage. And we gave them a retention test. So they heard a tone, then they heard distraction sounds, and they heard another tone. And this is the error rate over here. What's interesting here is that the lesions on the right side produced a very large increment in the error rate for the interference task. But also the patients with excisions in the frontal cortex over here, mostly inferior frontal and middle frontal. So the error rate here was also enhanced. And so what this means is that, again, this ventral stream is involved in not just the representation of the information, but also in concatenating these sounds over time. And that's important because the most interesting part, I think, of the ventral stream is that not only does it hold on to information, not only does it compute the relationships across sounds as they unfold in time, but also that it's able to make predictions about upcoming sounds. And of course, you couldn't make predictions about upcoming sounds if you had not encoded the sounds that have happened and their relationships. So in a number of different experiments that many different people have done, I've given you just two examples here from Mark Schoenwieser and from Barbara Tillman, responses in more ventral auditory regions and inferior frontal cortices are found when there's a violation of an expected pattern. So you hear a certain pattern of sounds, and then there's another sound that doesn't fit into that pattern, and this causes a measurable response in these regions. What's interesting here is that a deviation is only a deviation if you have a prediction of what's coming. Otherwise, it's just a sound, right? So the reason these studies are interesting is because it tells us that there's some kind of active element going on here where sounds are being encoded, their relationships are being computed, and some predictions are being made based on what's happened previously about what's going to happen next. And that's a concept which we're going to come back to when we talk about musical pleasure, this whole concept of prediction. So I've given you some examples of the different functional properties of these streams, of these cortical-cortical loops. So they enable the encoding of relevant sound features, very basic features in more belt and parabelt regions. Their relationships are computed actually in both streams to some extent. We know that these loops are involved in sensory-motor interactions. Importantly, and something I haven't mentioned, I don't have time to talk about, is that we see a lot of enhancement of these loops in individuals who have a lot of musical training. So in the case of musical performance, for instance, I showed you how this dorsal stream is very important for the learning of something like playing an instrument. When we look at highly trained musicians, we see changes in the anatomy of that pathway, for example. And then these systems are also involved in maintaining information, in manipulating information in working memory, and in creating these expectancies, which are based on sensitivity to regularities that occur. These are usually thought of as statistical regularities. So you have a sequence of events from which some computation can be made about what's next. But the title of my talk was From Perception to Pleasure. So what does this have to do with pleasure? You're asking yourself. So we asked ourselves that question too at some point. And to answer this, we have to go to a very different system from the cortical-cortical loops that we've been talking about. We have to go to a set of brain structures that are found deep in the brain, which are collectively thought of as the reward system. This is a rather loose term. It includes a lot of different structures. I'm focusing really on the basal ganglia part of this system, but it's much broader than that, because there are brainstem nuclei, the ventral tegmental area, the medial forebrain bundle, that are actually the origin of a lot of the dopaminergic projections that end in the basal ganglia. And it also typically is thought to involve orbitofrontal cortex, medial frontal cortex, amygdala, and other structures as well. Many different investigators working both in animal models and in humans have described the striatum, which consists of two subdivisions, the dorsal striatum, which is part of the caudate, and the ventral striatum, where the nucleus accumbens is located. So collectively, they're known as the striatum. And this mesolimbic structure has been described as being involved in many different kinds of processes, broadly speaking, thought of as involved in reward or repetitive types of behaviors in the animal literature, but also in things that have to do with motivation or salience. It is very well established that these systems are dopaminergic in nature. Dopamine is the neurotransmitter that really mediates these responses. And in particular, there's a very interesting concept developed by Wolfram Schultz and a number of other people, that what the system does is actually encodes reward prediction error. In other words, the system responds not just to the reward, but to the degree to which the reward is expected. So in a very simple case, as Schultz showed many years ago, you train a rat to expect a certain amount of food when a cue is presented, a light, let's say, and the dopamine neurons respond initially, and then once the animal has learned what the task is, those neurons become quiescent. But they fire very vigorously if the reward is greater than what happened on previous trials. So that's a positive reward prediction error. Whereas if the reward is withheld or it's smaller in magnitude, then you have an inhibition of those dopaminergic responses. So there's a way in which the system is encoding the reward value of an event that's coming up. And so we'll come back to that concept as well when we think about musical pleasure. Now, there's a lot of work done in animals, a lot of physiology and pharmacological kinds of studies. With human research, there is increasingly more work on this. And this is from a nice meta-analysis by Guillaume Siscous, who looked at large numbers of fMRI studies involving stimuli that are thought of as reward-related stimuli, to look at what's common between them. And so here in the left column, you have studies that involve monetary rewards. These are typically sort of gambling tasks or video game kinds of tasks where you're performing some task and you get some kind of money or you get some kind of monetary outcome. These are experiments with food rewards where people are hungry and they're being shown pictures of delicious food in the scanner, or in some experiments are actually given some food through a tube. And these are studies on erotic rewards, and I will leave to your imagination the nature of the stimuli in those cases. But what's interesting is that in all three of these, you have a common response in the striatum. So this is the overlap of the three types of stimuli, as shown here. And you have a very strong response in the striatum, as well as in other structures, in particular in the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. So we wondered whether music might engage these same mechanisms, because we know music is extremely pleasurable and many people will find it rewarding. And so the hypothesis was that perhaps it would activate the same system, even though music is unlike these other stimuli in the sense that it is not a primary reinforcer the way that food or sex might be, because those are necessary for survival of the individual or of the species, respectively. And monetary rewards are not primary reinforcers, but they are secondary reinforcers because you can use them to obtain primary reinforcers. Music, however, doesn't have any of those properties. It's not biologically necessary. It's not a secondary reinforcer. You can't use music to purchase something that you want. So would it engage the same mechanism? So we thought about this for a long time, and it was very difficult to think of how to study this in a scientifically rigorous manner. But working with Anne Blood, who was a postdoc in my lab at the time, this is about, almost 20 years ago now, we came up with the idea that what we really need is an index of pleasure that is really, that can be measured objectively. So we wanted a phenomenon that we could measure and that would be reproducible and stable, because studying musical pleasure can be challenging because it's so subjective. And so what we came up with was this idea of studying chills or frissons. So this is a sensation that many people experience when they perceive music that is highly pleasurable. You don't have to be musically trained. Most people know what this is. What's nice is that it's very often specific to a particular musical passage. That's nice for us experimentally because it means we know when to scan, because we know when the maximum pleasure should be occurring. There are physiological changes associated with it, which I'll show you in a second. And people describe this sensation as being extremely pleasurable. Some people say it's ecstatic, some people say it's euphoric. So we thought this is a good way to look at it. And indeed, when we look at the behavior, for instance, we take a passage of music that a person has selected as being music that gives them this strong type of chill response. And there, when we look at the ratings, we see a peak, of course, where they said a chill was happening, and we see no such peak in control music, which is actually the music used by a different participant who gets chills to it. So this is a way to avoid a problem that was initially quite difficult to solve, which is that different people had different tastes, and some people like one piece of music over another. So this is one way to get around that. Now, this is purely subjective ratings, right? But we can look at psychophysiology by measuring skin conductance, skin temperature, heart rate, blood volume amplitude, and respiration. These are all physiological indices of arousal. And when we look at those, what we see is, in fact, a nice correspondence between between the subjective response and the objective physiological responses. There's a peak in all of the different indices at exactly the time that we would expect. So this is very nice because it means that now we have an objective way to be sure that the response that we observe subjectively is not just a participant telling us, you know, whatever, because they want to get out of the experiment and they're bored, but it's actually what they're feeling. So armed with this type of protocol, we did our very first study published back in 2001. This is in the days when we were doing oxygen 15 positron emission tomography, which is a way of measuring cerebral blood flow. And this is very low resolution by today's standards, but at the time it was pretty cool, actually. And we did see a response in the ventral striatum, and that was the very first time that such a response had been observed. So we were sort of excited by it. One thing that's interesting is that there's no real commonality in the musical pieces that elicit chills. It's really very specific to different people. And I don't know if this will work if I try to play this, but here's one piece of music that we used. It's not a very controversial choice. This one is a little bit different. I usually want to run away when I hear that, but one person thought that this was extremely pleasant and gave them significant chills. Here's a little jazz piece. It's kind of nice. So very, very different types of music, but they all give the same response. That's what's really interesting about it. So we thought, okay, this paradigm's pretty good. Let's see if we can exploit it a little bit more, because this is a very nonspecific response. Here we're just looking at cerebral blood flow. And remember, the hypothesis is that this ventral striatum system is dopaminergic in nature. And so we needed to go to a to obtain greater chemical, neurochemical specificity. So in work done by Valerie Salimpour, what we did was use a different kind of PET technology using a tracer, carbon-11 raclopride. Raclopride is a synthetic molecule which binds to dopamine D2 receptors. And when you label it with carbon-11, which is a positron emitter, you have a way of tracing the activity in the brain that's specific to dopamine. I should say that it has affinity really only for the basal ganglia and not for the cortex, so we're sort of blind about what's happening in the cortex here. But the cool thing was that when we repeated the identical paradigm with chills, responses, and so forth, we see a very nice response that's dopamine-specific in the striatum, bilaterally and both dorsally and ventrally. And when we compare it to the previous study, you see that it's roughly the same location. Not entirely, because there's more dorsal activity here. And this is a bit puzzling, in fact, that we were seeing such a distinction between the two structures, the more dorsal and the more ventral. And so Valerie decided that we needed to explore that further. And the problem with the PET raclopride technique is that it is something like a 60-minute scan or so, because you need to obtain enough samples for the procedure to work. And so it was temporally very nonspecific. So what we did was we took the same participants with the same music and put them back into the fMRI scanner this time. And then we looked in the regions that had been identified by PET as being dopaminergic, having a dopaminergic response. We looked at what was happening in those regions in the fMRI. And fMRI, although it's not especially temporally sensitive compared to EEG or MEG, you can still obtain a scan every few seconds. So it's considerably better than the PET technique. And what we saw when we did that is if we separate the time period in terms of the chill response, because people were responding when they felt a chill, they were instructed to press a button. So we knew when it was happening. And if we time lock the fMRI responses to the time period prior to the chill versus after the chill, we see a nice separation between the dorsal and ventral striatum, which you see here. So during a period of about 15 seconds or so prior to the peak pleasure, the dorsal striatum has a larger response. And then at the time of peak pressure, it basically drops down. And the ventral striatum suddenly rises. So there's a sort of biphasic response, which is both which is temporally segregated and anatomically segregated, telling us that there is a difference between what's going on during the anticipatory phase and what I call the experiential phase, which is associated with the actual hedonic response of experiencing the pleasure. And when we look in the anatomical literature, for example, we see that there's interesting patterns of connectivity, anatomical connectivity, between the dorsal and the ventral striatum. So people like Haber and Knudsen have described the dorsal striatum as being more sort of cognitive in nature, if you will, in the sense that it is connected to structures that are to do with higher order cognition, such as dorsal lateral frontal cortex, also cingulate cortex, which is involved in decision making. And these structures, of course, are also important for things like planning and executive function, et cetera. So it makes sense that the concept of anticipation might be linked to these more anterior structures. Conversely, the ventral striatum is thought of as being more affective in nature because it's connected to structures that perhaps could be thought of as having more to do with the hedonic response itself, including amygdala, the ventromedial frontal cortex, brainstem structures of various sorts. It's also interesting that this concept of anticipation and pleasure is echoed in the writings of music theorists. Going back into the 1950s, for example, Leonard Meyer proposed that music elicits emotion by virtue of expectancies and the creation of tension and resolution. And this is a very common concept in music theory, that you have an expectation based on a pattern of sound, and then the musician, the composer, or the performer will resolve that to a greater or to a lesser extent. Similarly, David Huron has suggested, has really expanded upon this concept of anticipation as being the source of a lot of musical pleasure. So this was where we stood a few years ago, but we decided, okay, this chills paradigm is very nice. We've exploited it quite a bit, but it has some potential weaknesses. One of them is that one could argue that, okay, chills, it's great when you get them, but most of the time when you listen to music, you don't, in fact, experience chills. It's only on occasion. And so maybe this dopaminergic response is only associated with those particular moments, but doesn't actually explain 99% of music listening when you don't have a chill. That's one problem. And another potential problem is that in all these experiments, we necessarily used familiar music because we asked participants to select the music that they knew would give them the chill response. And so maybe some of what we're seeing is confounded with memory functions of some kind. So we thought, okay, we need to move to a very different paradigm where we want to move away from chills and we want to use novel music. And so how do we do this? It's very hard to think about how to do it, but Valerie came up with, I think, a very clever and original way to look at this, and it's what we call the iTunes experiment, where you listen to musical excerpts that you're not familiar with, so these are completely new excerpts, and you hear them only for 30 seconds, and then during that time, you have to decide if you want to purchase it or not, and you put money in terms of the value that you assign to it. So each individual person listens to the music, we scan their brain. At the end of 30 seconds, they give the value of it. They say, okay, this one is zero, this one's 99 cents, this is $1.29, these are the prices on iTunes in 2011 when we did the study. I don't know if it's gone up. Actually, no one uses iTunes anymore, right? It's because you can stream everything for free if you find the right websites. In any case, we then use the value assigned by each individual for each piece of music as the regressor on the brain data. So this is nice because it allows us to have a large number of excerpts. We had 70-something different excerpts, and allows us, it accounts for different tastes. So different people will say yes or no to different pieces of music. And again, just to entertain you, I'll play some music. So these are some of the pieces that we were using. In this case, we confined our experiment only to, I guess it was called indie techno or something like that, which was very popular amongst our McGill students in early in the 2010s. Would you pay a dollar for that? No, I wouldn't pay 1 cent for that, but here's another one. Not 99 cents, anybody? No? This is my favorite, actually. I like that syncopation. Okay, so you get the idea. And so what we do in the analysis, as I said, is we use the dollar amount as the regressor. And what we see is that, in fact, the place where the value, the place in the brain where the value is expressed most strongly is in the ventral striatum. So the more activity you get in this region as the value assigned by each participant to each piece of music increases. So this means that these responses that we keep seeing very consistently across all of these studies are not specific to familiar music, because these were absolutely the first time they heard it, and they're not specific to the chills response, because there were no chills associated with any of this music, I don't think, and we still see that we get this response. We did one further analysis, which I think is extremely important in bringing a lot of these things together, which is that we looked now at the degree to which this ventral striatum is communicating with the rest of the brain. And we looked at the degree to which that communication, which we quantify in terms of functional connectivity, we look at how that functional connectivity changes as a function of the reward value. And what we find is that the functional connectivity, which is essentially nothing more than the correlation of the time courses of the two regions, so two regions that fluctuate in a similar way will have a high functional connectivity. If they fluctuate differently, they'll have a low functional connectivity. So the functional connectivity increases quite significantly for the more valued items compared to the less valued items. And I think this is extremely important, because what it does is it links together these two systems that we've been talking about. It links together the auditory cortical system, which was the first half of the talk, with the reward system. So when items are extremely rewarding, there's more interaction, there's more crosstalk between the cortical perceptual system and the subcortical valuation system. So that concept is what we've been working on in the very recent past, and we're actively working on it right now. And it leads to several testable hypotheses, and these are the last few slides I'll show you. So if this is true, in some sense, if this interaction is really critical to what we're talking about, it should be the case that loss of musical pleasure should be associated with disruptions of the system, right? If what I'm claiming is correct. So what do we mean by loss of musical pleasure? Well, it could be different things, but we were able to find a population of individuals that we refer to, so I'm just going to talk about this first part now, that we refer to as people with musical anhedonia. And this is work done by Ernest Mas Herrero, who At the time he did the study, he was a student in Barcelona where I did my sabbatical. He's now a postdoc in my lab. And what Ernest did was develop a questionnaire scale called the Barcelona Music Reward Questionnaire, which captures the degree to which people respond emotionally to music. And we compare that to a standard anhedonia scale, which is used in psychiatry and captures, you know, depression and lack of pleasure to different kinds of stimuli. And what we found is that there are some people who score perfectly normally on the anhedonia scale, meaning that they're not depressed, they have a perfectly normal response to hedonic stimuli, but they just don't care for music. They just don't like it. It doesn't give them any emotional response. And this is also shown in this scale here. So the people with anhedonia on a valuation scale score quite poorly for music, whereas they like food, they like money, they like sex, just like all the rest of us. We also had a group of people that we call musical hyperhedonics, or I like the word in French, méloman. I think that's very good. So some of us in this room might be in this category. And these people are interesting because they over-respond to music, but again, they're in the normal range for all the other things. So the first thing we did was we tested them with a psychophysiological paradigm that I illustrated to you earlier, using skin conductance and heart rate as our measures. And the people with anhedonia, in fact, show essentially no response, either with skin conductance or with heart rate. So what they're telling us in their questionnaire is really true. They don't feel any emotion to music. You play the music and they're like, yeah, I told you. I just don't care about it. These are the average people with normal hedonic response. These are the hyperhedonics who have a slightly elevated response in skin conductance. And that's also illustrated in the skin conductance responses here. These are the anhedonics who, there's a little peak there that's really due to one individual that was in our group. All the rest of them were really essentially just going down, whereas the other two groups show a very strong response to music that induces chills. Importantly, we did a control task, which is a monetary incentive delay task. It's essentially a gambling task where you sometimes get better or worse outcomes than you're expecting. You have to play a little game, and every so often you get some money. Sometimes you get a lot more money than you expect. And when you get that large gain, so-called, you have a big skin conductance response because it's really exciting when you're playing this game and you suddenly get a lot more money than you thought you were going to get. And all three groups are perfectly superimposed on this task. So the people with musical anhedonia, they like money just like everybody. It's really specific to music. So we put these people into a scanner, which is a project done by Noelia Martinez. The red bars are the anhedonic subjects. This is the response to the gambling task. This is the response to the music task on both sides. The other colors are the other two groups. So normal responses in the other two groups to both types of tasks, but a very diminished response specifically in the ventral striatum. So this interaction between each of the three groups and the two tasks is most strongly expressed actually in the ventral striatum, as well as in a few other regions here. So this goes along very well with the idea that these individuals don't have a response to music emotionally because their reward system is not being recruited. And in fact, when we look at the functional connectivity, using the auditory cortex as a seed region, we look to see, well, where does the connectivity differ most across those three groups? And it differs in terms of the connectivity between auditory cortex and ventral striatum. And that's shown here, which I think is particularly convincing, that the people with anhedonia, when they're hearing this music that everyone else finds pleasurable, they don't have an increase in their connectivity between these two structures, whereas the other subjects do, particularly the hyperhedonics, have a particularly strong response there. So this is the same phenomenon that I showed you earlier in Valerie Salimpour's study, where the more value, the more money you assign to the music, the greater is the coupling between these two systems, right? So we see that here too, but not in the people with anhedonia. Finally, we looked at their anatomical connectivity. Now, there are no connections anatomically between auditory cortex and ventral striatum. The connections are all indirect. They go through various structures, but one of the more important structures would be the orbitofrontal cortex. So we identified regions of interest in auditory cortices and in orbitofrontal cortices, and then did tractography using diffusion imaging to look at the connections between those two structures. And then we quantified the degree of diffusivity in this pathway as a function of the score on the reward questionnaire. And what we find is people who score low, that is to say people who have musical anhedonia, tend to have the highest levels of diffusivity, both mean diffusivity and axial diffusivity in this tract, as you see here. People who score high tend to have the lowest diffusivity. And of course, diffusivity is thought to correspond to the organization of the white matter tracts. So the more strongly organized they are, the lower is the diffusivity. If you have a lot of diffusivity, it means that the tract is not well organized. Now, it could be many different things. It could be crossing fibers. It could be smaller size tracts, smaller number of connections, etc. But this is an anatomical link that might explain why some people don't have this response to music, is because their connection here is somehow disrupted. So we see evidence that loss of musical pleasure is indeed linked to disruptions of this interaction, both from the functional point of view and from the anatomical point of view. Now, if you're a real critic, and our reviewers often are, they say, well, that's all great, but it's all correlational. All you've shown is that it's a correlation between one phenomenon and another phenomenon. You haven't actually shown a causal influence. So we thought, okay, can we get actual causal evidence for these claims that we're making? In particular, can we manipulate the activity in the striatum, directly or indirectly, in such a way as to see if we could influence the musical pleasure response? And so to do that, we turn once again to transcranial magnetic stimulation. And it turns out that there's a technique that had been developed by Tony Strafella and Thomas Paus a few years ago, where they demonstrated that if you target the dorsolateral frontal cortex with transcranial magnetic stimulation, and then you scan people using that raclopride technique that I showed you earlier, you see dopamine release in the striatum when you stimulate this frontal region. You don't see that if you stimulate another control region. The reason is because there's a massive connection between the striatum and the dorsolateral frontal cortex. So when you stimulate over here, even though the striatum is very deep in the brain, you can't stimulate it directly. We'd like to put an electrode directly in there, but they won't let us. You can stimulate indirectly by going on the surface, and this had already been shown quite a number of years ago. So what we decided to do was essentially to apply this model, stimulate up here, influence the striatum, and then test using our musical paradigms, both the purchasing paradigm, where you're deciding how much you want a piece of music by assigning value, monetary value to it, and the liking response, which is associated with the chills response. One nice thing is that we can use a theta burst protocol, which other people have developed with two flavors of it. So you can use continuous theta burst or intermittent theta burst, and these have been shown, particularly in the motor system, to result in inhibitory or excitatory responses, respectively. So that means that we can both upregulate or downregulate the response. And so this was Ernest's postdoc work, which was just published at the end of last year. And so what he did was you hear the music, you give real-time ratings as you're hearing it, but depending on the condition, prior to starting the music listening, you get a sequence of inhibitory TMS on one day, excitatory TMS on another day, or a sham kind of stimulation on the third day. And these are, of course, counterbalanced for order. And what I'm showing you here is a percent change with respect to the sham condition in each of our variables. So when you get the inhibitory T, when you get the intermittent theta burst, which is excitatory, your liking rate goes up relative to sham by a little bit. And when you get the continuous, which is inhibitory, your liking rate goes down. So you get a change, a bidirectional change in the liking rates according to the type of stimulation. Similarly, when you look at electrodermal activity, we see an increase in skin conductance with the excitatory protocol and a decrease with the inhibitory protocol. And finally, when we look at the monetary amount, you get the same pattern. So all three of these things can be modulated by the stimulation, which is frankly a little bit scary that it works so well. And we've recently just replicated this with a separate sample of individuals. So it seems to be a pretty robust finding. So now we have causal evidence in favor of the role of the striatum. But it's still not causal evidence in terms of dopamine, because what we're doing is modulating the overall activity of the structure, but it's not neurochemically specific, right? It's just these pulses. So to look at causal evidence for the role of dopamine, we turn to a pharmacological paradigm. And this is brand new work that hasn't been published yet, carried out by Laura Ferrari and a bunch of our colleagues in Barcelona at the Hospital de la Santa Creu y Sant Pau. And this is really kind of a heroic experiment, which involved, you know, a lot of very careful controls, selecting people to be able to give them these pharmacological manipulations. These are very healthy young individuals who aren't taking any other drugs, and so on and so forth. And in the experiment, we administer either risperidone, which is a dopamine antagonist, or a placebo, or levodopa, which is, of course, a dopamine precursor. And the idea is that we're manipulating dopamine responses pharmacologically. This is done over the course of one day. And the 3 days are separated by quite a long time. And of course, they're counterbalanced. And it's the same type of task. You hear the music. It may give you chills or not. You give a subjective rating. We also measure skin conductance. And we also do the purchasing, where you have to say how much money would you give. And these are data I just got from Laura a few days ago. And it's very exciting because when we look at the, percent change for each of the two drugs as compared to placebo, so zero means there's no change. This is for music that elicits chills versus high pleasure versus low pleasure. There's no real change for the low pleasure or for the high pleasure. But for music that gives you chills, there's definitely, at least there's definitely an inhibition of the response with risperidone, which is the dopamine antagonist. And there's maybe a little bit of elevation in the levodopa group. This works better for the electrodermal response. So this is just the skin conductance. It goes down with risperidone, goes up with levodopa. And it works especially well with the monetary response. It really goes up quite a lot with the levodopa. It doesn't really change much with the risperidone. And just to show you the skin conductance response, you see a nice separation of the traces over time to the music when the people are taking levodopa versus risperidone. Again, percent change relative to the placebo condition. Again, and importantly, we do the usual control task, which is this monetary incentive delay task, where you're comparing the payout of a lot of money versus a little bit of money. And we see a very similar modulation, which is expected because, of course, the whole idea is that we're modulating the dopamine system. We know that these gambling tasks depend very much on dopaminergic transmission. And so, in fact, we get the same kind of changes associated with that, which means that in this particular case, we're not trying to dissociate the music from the gambling like we were in the other experiments. In fact, they're associated, they're going together. So I think we have at least some causal evidence specifically for the role of dopamine. And so if we put all of this information together, I hesitate even to call this a model because it isn't really, certainly is not formally a model. There's no computation behind it. It's just an idea, I guess. But the idea is basically this, that on the one hand, we have these cortical systems which allow us, as I said in the first half of the talk, to encode information, determine relationships between patterns of sounds, anticipate upcoming events, make predictions about what's going to happen next. And that's all cognitive, right? That requires a lot of sophistication in cortical systems. And indeed, many of these structures, particularly the frontal ones, are the ones that are most highly advanced in a phylogenetic sense, since those are the most developed parts of the human brain compared to other primates. But what's really interesting is that that whole system then comes into communication with this more phylogenetically ancient system, which is really there for some very basic functions that are arguably, you know, arguably important for biological survival. And perhaps that's where music gets its power, is because it consists of the interaction of our most highly developed cognitive abilities that are also very strongly linked to learning and training and experience and culture. And it links that to some of the most basic biological systems that have to do with pleasure, with reward, with motivation, and with survival. And so I think this is basically our working idea at the moment, and it remains to be refined, perhaps, in terms of figuring out what the computations really are. And with that, I just want to end and thank all of the many, many people that have contributed to all these different studies, and also our funding agencies, without which we couldn't do the research. And voilà, c'est tout. Merci beaucoup.